Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, homeopathy. This is a special broadcast on homeopathy and federal health agencies' attempts to limit America's access to it. We have four panelists today. From Evanston, Illinois, will be Dr. Toni Bark. She is a pediatric physician and a prestigious homeopathic doctor practicing in the Chicago area. She is the former vice president of the American Institute of Homeopathy, and she has a medical degree from Rush Medical College and a pediatric internship at New York University. She also has degrees in psychology, as well as a master's in healthcare emergency management from Boston University Medical School. She trained under Dr. Erica Fromm at the American Society for Clinical Hypnosis. She is also the co-producer of the documentary film Bot, which shows how Big Pharma and Big Food have sold out our health. Her website and blog is disease-reversal.com. She will be joined by Dr. Mitchell Fleschner. Dr. Mitchell Fleschner is a board-certified physician and family physician. He specializes in integrative medicine for over 30 years. He is also a specialist in classical homeopathy, as well as nutrition, botanical medicine, and bioidentical hormone therapy. He has a medical degree from Stanford University School of Medicine and later served on the clinical faculties of the National Center for Homeopathy, the University of Virginia Health Science Center, and the Medical College of Virginia. He is also a graduate of Hahnemann College of Homeopathy and the New England School of Homeopathy, where he served on their faculties. He is a fellow of the American Academy of Family Physicians, and his website is alternativemedicare.com. And he is joined by Dr. Ronald Whitmont. Dr. Whitmont is a board-certified physician in internal medicine and a second-generation homeopathic physician. His father was a well-known classical homeopath and Jungian analyst, Edward Whitmont. He received his degrees from Hampshire College and SUNY Downstate Medical School. He has been on the medical staff of Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and the Hospital of Special Surgery in New York City. And he was raised on the principles of Rudolf Steiner and the Quaker tradition. He's lived in an ashram in India while working at a rural health clinic serving the lower castes, and later worked at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation Hospital. He currently has a practice both in Rhinebeck, New York, and Manhattan. His website is homeopathicmd.com. And they are all joined by Dr. Christopher Johnson. Dr. Johnson is a naturopathic physician, a homeopathic doctor practicing in Arlington, Virginia. He is currently the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Homeopathic Medicine, a journal of the American Institute of Homeopathy, which has been in print since 1909. He has degrees from University of Virginia and Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine, and he is also a peer reviewer of the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine, and his website is worldofhomeopathy.wordpress.com. First, I'd like to welcome all of you to the program. Let me give a little background, and we're going to start with you, Toni.
Sure.
I'm going to begin with a conversation in reverse. Rather than start with the legitimacy and effectiveness of homeopathic medicine for certain medical conditions, I want to focus first on the socio-medical climate today that homeopathic medicine finds itself in. Earlier, Dana Allman was on my noon broadcast addressing the Australian study that tried to debunk homeopathic altogether. Now, more recently, earlier this month, the FDA has stepped up its assault against homeopathic medicine. I think what is on most people's minds who either have personally experienced homeopathic effectiveness or knowledge of it from maybe another alternative medical therapy is why such an effort is being made to discredit it. Homeopathic medicine is protected by the FDA at the federal level as legal drugs. And for that reason, unlike foods or nutritional supplements, homeopathy can make disease claims. However, unlike Big Pharma's prescription and over-the-counter drugs, homeopathic medicines do not have to undergo the standard FDA new drug approval process. Now we're witnessing the FDA possibly attempting to do just that. Although the scientific critics against homeopathy, such as the Australian medical system, would claim these medicines are nothing but water, homeopathy has always had a stressed relationship with conventional drug-based medicine since before the Flexner Report commissioned by the Rockefellers. So, Tony, please begin by sharing some of the rather shaky relationship homeopathy has had with the established medical establishment and why it's been so difficult.
It's not in isolation. So this is going on at the same time when we are seeing 117 bills in 35 states to erode vaccine exemption rights. This is also going on about a year or two after we saw a slew of bogus class action lawsuits in the state of California brought against a few very large homeopathic formulators. We have Paul Offit, who has written, a book in the last year, not his most recent book, but on how ridiculous supplements and vitamins are. And we have, in the last week, FDA is now at the push of a bunch of chemical companies going after homemade soaps. So this isn't, and there's more, but this isn't in isolation. You know, what we are seeing, and the reason the Australian government went after homeopathy is that so many people use homeopathy in Australia. In fact, there's a lot of opting out. They are allowed philosophical objection to vaccination, and a lot of people are using homeoprophylaxis there. And I feel that the pharmaceutical industry, as well as the chemical industry, has just gotten together and decided to systematically attack everything that is not pharma. So it's not in isolation. It's not just picking on homeopathy. The issue with the FDA is really talking about, we have to prove they're safe again. In 1938, it was declared, I think it was a senator who actually pushed this through, and they showed that they were safe. And so because they're safe, they go through the pharmacopoeia. It's kind of a voluntary process, in fact, but there is a group of people that sit on the U.S. Pharmacopoeia of the United States, which looks at the approval of new homeopathic remedies or drugs, and they do go through some process to show some clinical efficacy. They don't have to show safety because they have been safe. That's been proven. They're safe. There's such a great track record. We've never had any issues with that. But that's really what this is about. And if the FDA gets its way, which it's not really its way, pharma's kind of behind all these bills and all these events going on right now. And so if pharma gets its way, homeopathic remedies will have to undergo these rigorous studies that cost on average $6 to $8 million, and because they're not patentable and because no one entity can own one of the many hundreds if not thousands of homeopathic remedies, there's no entity that's willing to put up $6 to $8 million to do a rigorous study on, let's say, lycopodium or platina or phosphorus or any of these remedies, because they'd get nothing out of it. Anyone would be capable of selling it. So this would be basically, there'd be no homeopathy if the FDA passes this. And this is truly pharma's hand behind all of this big, I don't want to say conspiracy, but it's really whittling away because they see that their market share is being crept up upon, and pharma has invested in nanomolecular pharmacology now. They are looking at, which is the future of medicine. So they, in fact, themselves are looking at what they would call nanopharmaceuticals, which is a fancy word for homeopathy.
All right, I want us to pull back for a moment, look at the larger picture. Only by looking at that can we have a better understanding of why vitamins, minerals, herbs, and homeopathic practices are being attacked. Not just attacked to try to discredit them, but to try to put them out of business completely. It was 10 years ago that a physician came into my office. This was a board-certified physician, and he said, I came here because one of my patients claims that by coming to see you that they had improved their overall health, and I don't believe it's possible because I don't believe that anything outside of orthodox science-based medicine is going to help people. And I said, well, why don't you do this? Why don't you take a look at our library? He said, what library? I said, well, how many articles have you read on the chemistry, safety, and efficacy of vitamin C? He said, none. I said, well, there are over 30,000. And I went through each one of the different nutrients, and that wasn't even the highest amount. Vitamin E had more. And I said, and what do you think it shows or is the effective dose to really get intermittent claudication improved, oxygenation of the blood improved, heart disease, and helping to clean up the epithelium? And I said, if you look at the actual independent clinical studies, the potencies are above 1,200 milligram units and frequently higher. I said, however, you're coming in here to criticize something that you haven't even taken the time to study. And I said, I'm happy to give you over 500,000 studies, all from peer review independent science, because in my career I've learned it's always best to have the science there, because otherwise you're going to be debating someone who's trying to impress the audience with just their credentials or pedigree instead of the truth. He didn't want to see any of this. He was not interested. Fine. But then it got me thinking, why is it that everyone, every homeopath, naturopath, chiropractor, mind-body medicine person, psychoimmunologist, all of the people, complementary physician, holistic nurse, holistic dentist, why is it that every single one of these 88,000 practitioners are always on the defensive? They're always having to, in effect, almost genuflect and apologize for having done no harm to their patients and frequently a great deal of good. And so I involve five clinicians, all board certified, all academics, impeccable credentials, publishing hundreds of articles in peer-reviewed literature. And here was the simple statement. How much of orthodox medicine is currently accepted as scientific medicine actually works? By area, cardiology, neurology, gastroenterology, etc., oncology, rheumatology. It took us 5 years. Our ground rules were simple. We could only use their statistics. We could not use anyone else's. So if they were to argue the lack of objectivity in our research, we can say, we only used your studies. These were published by the Journal of the American Medical Association, by the New England Journal of Medicine, by the Lancet. After 5 years, we finally published our report. It was called Death by Medicine. We sent it out to 7,000 members of the American media, over 5,000 legislatures. All 50 state legislature members got it, meaning anywhere from 100 to 200 per state, plus every member of Congress. All told, with all the medical and scientific magazines and all the physicians, everyone, over 10,000 copies went out, not a single response. It showed that the number one cause of death and injury in the United States every single year for the past 20 years, we only used the last 20 years, was iatrogenesis or medically induced injury or death. And using only their figures. Now, mine were actually conservative. A professor at Harvard, who was the world's leading expert on iatrogenesis, actually had the numbers higher and closer to 1 million per year. That means more Americans die each year using current scientific accepted, FDA approved, and CDC sanctioned medical practices than heart disease or cancer or stroke or diabetes. And yet there's not a single group, not a single effort by Congress, the FDA, not a single state medical board or national medical board, not the Academy of Medicine or the National Academy of Sciences, has sought to address this issue. So on the one hand, they'll go after getting rid of a vitamin in a heartbeat with misinformation. And about every 6 months, they have another attack on supplements to which we have to then deconstruct their argument showing it's nonsense. And yet they, with the exception of emergency medicine, which is exemplary, that is the one area of about 12% of all medicine that saved lives, that works, that should be commended, 88% of all medical practices are neither proven to be safe nor effective for any given patient, and in fact kills patients. And yet you don't hear a word of criticism of the orthodox doctors. You don't hear doctors saying, you know, you're an oncologist. You're buying chemotherapy at $5,000, selling it to your patient directly for $12,000, the only area of medicine allowed to do that. And if you give them a vaccine and it kills every single patient, you're indemnified. Nobody can sue you. this isn't medicine. So I want you to take a look at this issue of attacking homeopathy and all other alternative forms of medicine in light of the fact that the emperor that is stark raving lunatic and naked at the same time, and that's a dangerous combination, being a naked lunatic, running up and down the corridors with her solid gold stethoscope, is American medicine and the defenders at the FDA, the CDC, the National Institutes of Health, etc. Please address this, Tony.
Well, you know why it happens? Because it's a racket. That's why. I mean, I'm listening to you, I'm thinking, it's a racket, Gary. That's why. You know, pharma's controlling it. The doctors are part of the problem. Most of them don't realize it. They really don't. They really don't. They don't know anything outside what they're taught. 30 years ago, when I went to medical school, the medical schools were not beholden to pharma. But that is not the case now at all. It has changed radically. So in the last 20 years, I think really what part of what changed, I mean, a lot of things changed in the laws, but advertising prescription meds directly to consumers, and that was, I believe, in the Clinton era, that really brought in a lot more money and changed the game. And we started seeing, you know, we always had some regulatory capture, really. You know, that's nothing new. But it is so captured, and now we have academia capture. So that's new. The academic capturing, you know, the capturing of academia is fairly new in the last 30 years. It really wasn't pervasive the way it is today. I mean, today it is the norm and not the exception. You know, it's the rule. And so I think that, one, doctors, even if they do know, they're loath to expose anything unless they're independent and on their own in their own private practice, because they will lose their, they will be harassed if they're at part of a medical center or a research center, if their department's getting funded. So they really can't talk out. You know, they're afraid of losing their job, their livelihood. They might be practicing some alternative stuff on the sly if they're in a system like that. And then if they're independent, even then many doctors just want to stay under the radar because they don't want to be harassed by the state medical board, you know, because that does happen as well. You know, if you're very successful in what you do, especially if you treat cancer patients, especially, and now autism, then you are attacked and the state comes after you. And it's bogus charges, it's trumped up charges, but it is still a pain in the ass. And so part of it is that it's a racket, pharma's behind it, there's a lot of money, and there's a lot of control, and doctors are either ignorant, you know, willfully part of it, you know, and in either sociopathic or just cut off, you know, like just they disconnect, there's a disconnect, or they're fearful. And that's really, I think, the bottom line.
Thank you. Christopher Johnson from Arlington, Virginia. Last month, the FDA held public hearings to reevaluate legislation approved back in the 1930s that ruled homeopathic medicine would be exempt from regular drug approval processes. Now, Chris, I understand you attended those hearings. One could put forth the argument that the FDA is trying to lasso every alternative health modality under its control and jurisdiction, including homeopathy, and this is one step further to that direction. Or it is a step to further make homeopathy more difficult to be practiced, getting it out of the way and opening more doors to conventional medicine. So what did you learn from the hearings, and in particular, what you perceive to be the reasons behind the FDA's move to reevaluate homeopathic medicine?
Well, Gary, I would have to say I'm not really sure. And the people that I talk, first of all, I'm not an expert on the FDA, and, you know, I mean, I know, you know, I read a lot of kind of shenanigans that go on there. I read about that, and I know about these kinds of things. But for people who are really kind of experienced at this, even they were not sure what the FDA's purpose is. I mean, Tony talked about pharma, and, you know, of course, you know, almost everything that happens in the medical community in the U.S. is going to be affected by pharma. But I don't know. I think that, to me, kind of my take is that the whole thing is a complicated picture. You have administrators working at the FDA. Some of them are definitely well-meaning. Many of them might not be as well. The well-meaning ones are going to be a little bit feel some fear based on you know, kind of a climate of fear that pervades when people are trying to bully and to put their point across. And to me, that's kind of my take in general on the whole scenario that we're talking about today, is that there's a fairly small but very vocal minority of people who are hell-bent on harming homeopathy, harming holistic medicine in general. Fall off, it's just one. There's a number. And pharma is more than willing to bankroll these people and that sort of thing. Now, whether that's exactly what's going on at the FDA, I mean, it's hard to tell. There is also some legitimate concern that I would say is legitimate, as far as there are some, you know, somewhat shady actors in the world of kind of commercial homeopathic products that are, you know, making products that aren't, you know, really fully honestly, you know, divulging what the materials are, what the ingredients are. So that's one aspect, but, you know, whether it's going to be more than that, we're hoping that that's all they're interested in. That may be naive. They may be out to do something worse. I'm really not an expert on the FDA. I do know that in the history of homeopathy, just outrageous behavior has occurred. The most unethical behavior you can imagine has been documented year after year in Europe and in the U.S., to harm homeopathy. I'm hoping that, you know, maybe one day we're going to start to move somewhat beyond this. Are we at that time? I'm not sure.
Chris, you were there. Tell us what you observed.
Well, what I observed was, it seemed to me that the panel members, well, what happened, Gary, is that a number of various experts would speak, and then they would get questions from the FDA panel members. These are FDA administrators. It seemed to me that some of the questioning was fairly harsh, occasionally hostile. But when I spoke to people who had observed this sort of thing in the past, they said it actually, they seemed somewhat friendly. So, I mean, that's a little bit of a hopeful sign. You know, I would not in any way disagree with everything that you and Tony have been saying, which is that there's absolutely a movement to essentially destroy homeopathy and holistic medicine by various parties.
Chris, you're also a naturopath, and historically, in the 1970s in particular, the FDA was going after naturopathy, and every state was trying to prevent the naturopathic community from being able to get legitimate, fully credentialed schools. And there was just John Bastier's school, and there was the National Homeopathic School. Others have opened up since and been accredited, but it was attacked then. What is the position? Are they attacking naturopathy today?
Well, yeah. I mean, the AMA Scope of Practice Partnership explicitly names naturopaths as a group that they, you know, amongst others, including nurses, chiropractors, acupuncturists, et cetera, who they would like to limit the scope of practice as well as limit any further licensing. So, I mean, it's not even a matter of speculation. Yes, the American Medical Association, along with various other specialty groups, medical groups, are aligned to do whatever they can, and they do so mostly on the state level, because that's where medical licensing takes place. So they fight us tooth and nail everywhere we're trying to get licensed. And naturopaths, by the way, are the only medical professionals that have homeopathic training, both didactically as well as clinically, of all the medical professions in the U.S. And so, you know, so it is, of course, homeopathy is a cause dear to all of our hearts in naturopathic medicine. So,
and this is the same AMA that wields enormous power over the state medical boards and what is considered acceptable scientific practice. And I went through all of their archives and found dozens of full-page ads for cigarette smoking, and where it said 44,000 doctors recommend Lucky Strikes, and then there was Philip Morris's recommended by thousands of doctors. Could you imagine how many people, average Americans, trusted the doctor who smoked, that if they smoked, and they're the people who know the most about health, and it's all right from everyone else to smoke, my mother and father, everyone in my hometown smoked. They thought it was all right. And when I asked my mother, she said, well, our doctor smokes, it can't be bad. And I said, yes, it can be. Oh, no, it can't. So, you know, the idea that the so-called sacred cow of American medicine, the AMA, is the highest standard of medical ethics is simply not the case. They also were found guilty of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act and restraint of trade and trying to destroy chiropractic and other other practices. And by the way, that conviction was upheld to the Supreme Court, so they could no longer deny chiropractors legitimacy, nor could they deny them coverage by Medicaid, nor could they continue their suit against them. Did you know that they had a secret Department of Investigations working for over 30 years in the basement of the AMA headquarters in Chicago? No one knew this until one day a envelope appeared at my home and my apartment in New York, and I read it, and it was all these documents. And I got so many documents, I wrote an article. In fact, I wrote two articles about the conspiracy against the chiropractic. And it showed how the AMA said it was unethical to refer a patient to a chiropractor or to accept a patient from a chiropractor. They were refused to be in classes, regular state classes, that a medical student would go through in pre-med. They did everything they could to denigrate chiropractic as an unscientific cult. And when the articles were published and a group of chiropractors sued, a man named Welk sued along with a group of about five other chiropractors, and one of their brothers was a lawyer in Chicago, and they got 1 million documents under discovery. Showed they had been conspiring to destroy all alternative therapies for decades. They had a whole department doing this. And by the way, when they closed down, guess who got their files? The Quackbusters. The Quackbusters.
Oh, interesting. That's
great. I have a letter. I actually have a letter from one of the Quackbusters to the Doyle Taylor at the AMA, who headed that department, and asking for them to get all their files. So suddenly, the AMA is told by the Supreme Court of the United States, you can no longer denigrate chiropractic, so it had to stop. You must recognize it as a legitimate scientific healing therapy, which it had to. You got to pay them several million dollars that went into this education fund. But then suddenly, the attack shifted from the AMA to these Quackbusters. Mm-hmm. And no one can figure out how they got all this information. Well, I got the letter showing they got the files. In any case, so the AMA, in my opinion, is an organization that should not exist.
Yeah.
It is worthless. It has no credibility. That was not the first time it's been convicted of violating the Sherman Antitrust Act and promoting quackery. In any case, I appreciate your input on that, Chris. Let's now go over to down from Virginia, Mitchell Fleischer. Mitchell, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Gary. It's good to be with my colleagues on the show with you.
Good. One of the most difficult tasks homeopathy has faced is to scientifically explain why dilutions that may have no molecule from the original substance left in the concentration still works. Now, the clinical evidence says it does. I have over 66 studies from peer-reviewed journals, double-blind, placebo-controlled, showing it works. And yet, your average physician will say, it can't work, it's just water. And I'm saying, it's based upon energy. And then I ask the doctor, what is the only thing missing when you're dead? Your heart, your eyes, your blood, they're all there. Energy. So why couldn't it be that the energy of a plant, a rock, or something else, the message in that energy is carried into the body? They can't wrap their mind around that. So could you explain this phenomenon, which is, to many, particularly those in the evidence-based medical camp who attack homeopathy repeatedly, seems absurd. And perhaps you can touch on some recent research I heard about for how homeopathic medicines may work about living systems conducted by Iris Bell and Mary Coltham, who discovered through their research that different homeopathic dilutions can in fact be distinguished from each other.
Well, essentially, Gary, this is a new premise of biophysics and nanomedicine, which Tony mentioned earlier, is now being explored by Big Pharma, because there's potentially a lot of money and a lot of very powerful healing agents that can be developed through that technology. You know, that's what they're doing with a lot of the new viral therapy and a lot of the new immunotherapy. They're finding that it works better in nanodilutions than it does in the higher potencies. And but there's been a lot of research over the last several years. You know, going back to Dr. William Tiller at Stanford in material sciences, where he did work with NMR, nuclear magnetic resonance, looking at different homeopathic potencies. I think he was doing natrium muriaticum, sodium chloride, and he found that there were spikes of energy in the higher dilutions when there wasn't supposed to be a single molecule. You know, the whole hullabaloo is about the homeopathic remedies being diluted beyond Avogadro's number, 6.023 times 10 to the 23rd molecules for mole. It's beyond that. But what we're dealing with here is bioenergetic medicine, nanomedicine. We're not dealing with biochemical reactions. It's not dealing at the level of the material body. It's the energy prior to that. And even Einstein, Whitehouse, and other physicists understood that it's the energetic force field that creates the matrix for the arrangement of the energetic particles in time and space, whether they're electrons, muons, quarks, doesn't matter. They're all highly condensed energy existing as substances waveform. And what we understand is that this is the biophysical basis of the whole universe, especially all living things. Certainly, there's a lot more research that needs to be done, but in my 30 years of practicing homeopathic medicine, I have seen, one, never seen an adverse reaction to correctly prescribed homeopathic medicine, and I've seen people come to me with really severe chronic illnesses who had been on allopathic medicines, had been cut, burned, and poisoned, and had really experienced much benefit from any of that, and with appropriately prescribed homeopathic medicines, really looking at all the physical, emotional, mental symptoms, which are simply all of our symptoms that we experience as human beings and all animals and things experience, are representations of an energetic imbalance, a bioenergetic imbalance that's expressed through the physical, emotional, mental symptoms. And by very carefully reading that pattern of symptoms, you're able to give a remedy that then acts as a bioenergetic catalyst or stimulus to give our innate God-given defense mechanism the energy and information to do what it would have done to begin with. So it's really, homeopathy really kickstarts our own healing engine and does it in a beautiful and gentle way when you prescribe appropriately. Now, one thing I wanted to mention with what you were discussing earlier about the AMA, it's very interesting in the history of American medicine. And if you really want to learn about the history of medicine, there's a beautiful book that was written called The Divided Legacy by Dr. Harris Coulter, late Dr. Harris Coulter. In the third book, it's all about the battle between homeopathy and the AMA. And very few people realize that the very first national medical organization in the United States, which was founded in 1844, was the American Institute of Homeopathy, which opened its doors to all practitioners of all sorts. Didn't matter whether you were a homeopath or an allopath, a Thomasonian, an herbalist, electrical doctor, didn't matter. Everyone was open to join and to participate in the medical society for the good of people. And then about two or three years later, the American Medical Association was formed as a trade organization, not intellectual organization, a trade organization. And in their founding charter was, we allopaths are coming together to crush the scourge of homeopathy. And as was mentioned before, Chris, and you mentioned it as well, they were medical societies throughout the United States and different states were going off their homeopaths, and they wouldn't let them be part of the societies. And in fact, I think there was a case of a homeopathic physician, well known in Connecticut, who was thrown out of the Connecticut Medical Society because he was cavorting with a homeopath who was his wife. So this has all been going on for a very, very long time. The AMA was really a weak organization until after the chemical industry started becoming larger and more powerful after the Civil War. And the chemical industry and the fledgling pharmaceutical industry really poured its money into the AMA, and it grew from there. And they started suppressing everybody else, and that's where the Flexner Report, all of that came from. But I think the bottom line is here is that what the FDA needs to understand is that if they want to really get a grasp on what homeopathy is and what it does, is to bring together homeopathic physicians, practitioners, whether it's MDs, DOs, NDs, whatever, who have been practicing this system medicine effectively for 2 or 3 decades, and we can share with them what we've seen from our experience. We know how these medicines work. We know how to prescribe them. We've followed, each of us collectively, thousands upon thousands of patients who have had serious illnesses and are now doing much better. And I think if they're going to do an honest job of it, they need to coordinate and speak with homeopathic physicians like Tony, Dick, myself, and others, and bring out the wealth of information for healing that we have available to them.
I appreciate those insights, Mitchell. Yes, Tony, you want to add something?
Yeah, the key thing that he said, if they want to do an honest job of it. And I hope that they do, and I do believe there are a lot of good people at the FDA, but I also believe, and I know from the few whistleblowers who've made it out, that they work for the industry primarily, at least the ones at the top. And so I think the key thing that you said there was if they want to do an honest job of it, but we don't know that that's the case.
Yeah, we don't know. It's a real shame. I mean, look what they did to that recent whistleblower. What was his name? William Thompson, who came up and admitted
that. Well, that's the CDC, right.
Yeah, he admitted the MMR caused autism and all those, the black, poor African-American kids. And have you seen it in the mainstream media? No. All you do is see it on natural news. You see it on the alternative media. You don't see it at all on the mainstream media. And
well,
yet this is an unbelievable scandal.
Unbelievable story.
Right. We did a 6-hour investigative reporting special live on Dr. Wakefield, and Wakefield's work would have been exonerated had Dr. William Thompson, epidemiologist since 1998 at the CDC, had he come forward and stated that he found a 323% increase in autism spectrum disorder in African-American children under the being vaccinated under the age of 36 months. That information was excluded clear up to Gerberding, who was the head of the CDC. Now, that's at the CDC. So on the one hand, if they allowed Dr. Thompson to speak openly, he's still working there.
Yeah.
That would suddenly give credibility to the people they've attacked. And it would undermine all of the studies they've done that were paid for by the Sorensen, who is now a fugitive on the run. 90% of all the studies that you hear referred to, there's no connection between autism and vaccine. Those are by the man who took millions of dollars and absconded and did all these crazy bad studies that they keep referring to. And Thompson,
well, Gary, let me just correct you. So Paul Thorson did 3 of the 25 that the CDC had been hanging their hat on to show disprove, you know, a debunking. And so Paul Thorson, it was 3 of them, and he is the most wanted fugitive for medical fraud. The other 22, though, however, was, you know, DiStefano and Thompson and Verstraten and a few others. And it was under Julie Gerberding's, when she was there. She's the one, I mean, presumably it came from her. They were told from higher up to omit this data, right, to omit the data. And so they pulled a few things, and it had to do with birth certificates in the state. And so it would have, let me just say that there was never a hearing for Wakefield. When there finally was a hearing last year in England for the rest of the group, it was dismissed on the very first day because there was no evidence against Wakefield or anyone else. So even, you know, that whole thing that happened 10 years ago, that few years ago, was trumped up. It was just a propaganda PR, machine that was started by Glaxo, and it wouldn't have mattered if Thompson had come forward then. He wouldn't have been heard, and there was no hearing. And the hearing that happened a year ago dismissed everything on day one because there was no evidence. And by the time Wakefield made his paper, done his research, there were already 27 published papers stating very similar findings. And since then, there's been dozens more papers stating with researchers with the same findings that autistic children, many of them have excessive amounts of measles virus in their system, that there's measles inclusions in their gut. There's all kinds of papers. So, he was picked upon because, yeah. And the brain, I don't know about the brain. I don't know. Are you asking me or you read that?
No, I heard Dr. Wakefield speak at University of Virginia around in the early 2000s, and he mentioned that some of the research of his colleagues, including the colleague that was exonerated by the UK court, that there was some evidence that At autopsy of some of the children who died, autistic children who died from other causes, there were measles inclusion bodies and on the neuronal tissue.
Well, we know we've seen that. We've certainly seen, in fact, I just read a case of a vaccinated child who died of measles inclusion body encephalitis a few years ago. Clearly it was a vaccine strain. So we know that that's a possibility, and there's certain varying degrees of how that affects children and how bad it is. So it's, you know, very plausible. But my point is that what happened to Wakefield had nothing to do with evidence lacking or not lacking. It was not about evidence. It was Brian Deere claiming he had things that he would have never had any access to. And if he did have access to patients' charts, it was certainly not through the normal ways, because none of those patients were cooperating with that side. They've all been siding with Andy, but never
okay,
off topic, I'm sorry.
I want to bring it back to our theme. The underlying issue here is that the federal agencies, the FDA, the CDC, the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and also the National Institutes of Health, Health and Human Services, all of them work as one when it comes to have a unified front on any major medical issue or public health issue. Now, the fact that they have used discredited people's material, or people are not themselves discredited, but their material was flawed, their methodologies were flawed, doesn't seem to matter, because they're indemnified. Where if you, any of you who are on this panel right now, if you were to intentionally, with malice aforethought, falsify data and submit it to a federal agency to get funding or to a peer-reviewed journal to get publication, your reputation is to be destroyed. And yet here we have Big Pharma who has an enormous rap sheet. In fact, I wanted to know. So I hired two attorneys who spent almost a year and came up with over 300,000 lawsuits that all these pharmaceutical companies had to settle. And not one person went to jail. Not one person's reputation was destroyed. The stock values went up, and yet they paid billions of dollars collectively in fines. So on the one hand, they're asking the public to be disinterested in homeopathy because they can't understand how it works. And yet what they claim works doesn't and injures and kills people. The people who have been mitigated in that walk free, because if they work for the federal government, you can't sue them. And then you end up having someone come in your office one day, and you can explain to a patient how homeopathy works. More often than not, they'll understand the larger concepts. And yet 900,000 doctors don't want to touch homeopathy. That I find really really unfortunate. Now, Ron, I want to come over to you, because evidence-based medicine, and in this group I would include all the reductionist medical practitioners such as Paul Offit and Stephen Novu and David Gorski and Seth Kelecham and the head officials of the CDC and the HHS, they have, in my opinion, personal opinion, they have an extremely narrow mechanistic view of the human body and biophysics. There are simply too many other mysteries to be discovered yet about the body and our biochemistry and how the environment affects and changes it. We also don't fully understand all there is to learn about the nature of energy, or even water for that matter. And several years ago, the French Nobel laureate, Dr. Luc Montagnier, who discovered the HIV virus, came out supporting homeopathy based upon his own research on the electromagnetic and vibrational properties of DNA in water. Now, how important is his research? And what I believe we need to come to terms with is that medicine is not a static science. It is constantly in change and flux with new discoveries and research. So when we look at homeopathy, how does it relate to newer understandings of the body and biomolecular operations and even biophysics that conventional medicine practice refuses to accept or simply ignores?
Well, Gary, I think that when you ask that question, what you're really asking is, where is medicine going? And I think, as Tony and Mitch and Chris have all said, is that homeopathy is really the future of medicine, if you think about it, because conventionally we are trained only to accept what you can feel, touch, or image, or measure in biochemical format. And homeopathy is not about that. Homeopathy, whether you have an explanation that it has to do with the memory of water or whether it has to do with nanoparticles or whatever. The bottom line is we don't know how homeopathy works, but we do know that it works in a different way than what conventional chemistry calls for and what how we have traditionally defined medicine, which is purely a chemical process. You can make an argument that, and I agree with you, what you said earlier, with the exception of emergency medicine and trauma care, there's very little in conventional medicine that is actually curative. In modern medicine, we're talking mostly about disease management. And by disease management, this means that we don't make the disease go away. We treat it and give you medicines that keeps you from feeling it and keeps you from having symptoms. But very little is cured, unless you're talking about trauma and emergencies. And this concept that you can actually make a difference, you can actually, with the correctly applied homeopathic medicine given in accordance with the individual characteristics of the patient and the individual characteristics of the expression of that disease, you might actually be able to influence the body's ability to resolve a condition. So this is why you mentioned that the AMA had this kind of underground secret research facility. It's probable that the pharmaceutical companies are doing the same thing with homeopathy. There's enough data on the use of homeopathy over the last 200 years with cured cases and published articles in research journals and peer-reviewed journals in homeopathy from around the world, that there's a huge amount of data available for how this medicine works. The bottom line is we don't know yet how it works, and we're always putting it into some kind of a mechanical model, and it just doesn't fit in that mechanical box. If you don't ever change your paradigm, you may not ever be able to concede that something like homeopathy could work. So it's a very difficult thing to get a handle on. And you also mentioned, I thought was very interesting, when you talked about the data that you had collected, I'm sure you're aware of the group from the United Kingdom called Clinical Evidence, who has basically gathered information on conventional therapies that are being used. And their number is almost exactly what your number is, that they estimate that only 12% of conventional therapies actually have scientific evidence behind them, and more than 50% have none, not a shred of it. So it's a very interesting thing that we're talking about homeopathy, and we don't know how it works.
Recently, there was over a dozen years ago, but there was a very famous study by a Japanese researcher who wanted to see what would happen to water when it was frozen, and then you looked at it. If meditators used their collective energy of meditation on a single word, if the word was love or peace, and if that would have any influence upon the crystallization of the water, how the water looked when it was looked upon in this way. And indeed, it took on unique shapes versus if there was no thought, no one meditating, and it just froze. It looked like charge of glass. But when you meditated, it took specific forms. Clearly, that is a form of energy. And I do not see that energy is so dissimilar than what you would consider the energy behind homeopathy. At one point or another, we are looking at a whole area of healing that there is no major scientific body that's willing to acknowledge because they just don't understand it. They're just
correct.
Too limited, in my opinion, to their perspective on this. Ron, would you address this first, and then I'd like the others to address it.
Well, it threatens the paradigm that we've been working in. If you say things only have a cause and a reaction, an action and a reaction in a physical universe, and you ignore the data that we have from modern physics that says the universe is non-local, you can define it you know, you can keep the definition in your own playground and not have to play with the rest of the kids on the block. But I think you're absolutely correct that the this whole concept that there's a non-physical force that's working here is very curious. We can't prove it, but we can show you scientifically, and we can show you in using the same criteria that you use to prove whether a conventional medicine is effective for a given condition or not. We have double-blind studies on homeopathy, and we have meta-analyses of many homeopathic studies, and they are clinically relevant and have been shown to be statistically significant and effective above and beyond placebo.
And the Swiss government did a beautiful study, clinical study of homeopathy over a number of years, showing its definitive benefit for the people of Switzerland. It was a very well done study. And
that it was financially worthwhile. That was a big part of it, that it was financially worthwhile relative to allopathic medicine.
Cost effective.
And we also have laboratory in vitro studies of homeopathy inducing breast cancer cell death, apoptosis, in the test tube, the laboratory.
Brilliant work that's being I think it's at Mayo Clinic he's working with them to do some oncological work with homeopathy.
Right, and MD Anderson Medical Center in Texas.
Right. And you're absolutely right. There's over 150, 200 years worth of thousands upon thousands of reproducibly cured cases using homeopathic medicine prescribed accurately by well-trained homeopathic physicians. And I think that...
And that's key.
Yeah, and that data needs to be brought forth.
What Mitchell said was key, which is with trained homeopathic physicians. So what is done often, as we all know, is a mainstream place that's set out to disprove homeopathy will perform their own studies. They're not trained in homeopathy. That's like me performing studies in neurosurgery. They're not trained in homeopathy. They don't know how to prescribe a remedy. They'll give everyone with headache the same remedy. Oh, this remedy doesn't work for headache because we did a study on it, but they don't even know what they're doing. That's not how homeopathy would work. You know, everybody with a headache could wind up getting a completely different remedy from each other. So they actually go out of their way to have people who know nothing about the field then do these studies so then they can say, see, it failed. We disproved that homeopathy works. And it didn't disprove anything.
He wrote this book on alternative medicine knowing absolutely nothing about what he was speaking.
And remember that what we're talking about with homeopathy is kind of unique to the United States, because in most European countries, homeopathy is part of the National Health Service. Over 40% of French physicians either prescribe homeopathically or refer
60%.
To homeopaths. It's like 60%.
And
the same
60%.
Is true with the United Kingdom and the Netherlands.
And Israel, it's part of the socialized medical system in Israel.
Medical colleges in India.
India is huge.
So worldwide,
Pakistan.
It's accepted. It's in the United States, where probably it's the AMA that has been a staunch adversary of homeopathy.
From the very beginning of the creation in 1847.
Yes, right. But one of the things about, you've mentioned physical and not physical, and I have to say that the electricity or the energy that runs through us that makes the difference between something alive and something dead is physical. We don't see it. It's not material where we can see it. We're not capable of picking it up with our senses, but it is, you know, it exists. It's energy. And so, it is part of the physical world. It's just the physical world that our senses can't pick up on.
Exactly.
So I just wanted to say that, you know, it's real. If you look at the spectroscopy, and I think one of you were alluding to this study, but, Gary, you mentioned Bell's study, but, you know, there was an earlier study done in the physics department, and they looked at the difference between NatMir and Nux Vomica
in
different potencies. It was, but it was also Rustam Roy's work.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And they looked at FTIR spectroscopy versus Raman. And, you know, when you're doing Raman spectroscopy, you pick up on structural information. And so the spectroscopies were very different based on which type of spectroscopy you used. And if it was just on the chemistry, the monograph of the chemistry, then, yes, it looked like water. But if it was based on the structure, it was very different, and the different potencies were different. I just wanted to throw that out there because...
Well,
that wasn't
Tony, we're out of time.
There's been several scientists throughout the world who've shown that even at very high potency, where there's allegedly no molecules left beyond Avogadro's number, there are energetic, distinct, and reproducible energetic patterns in the homeopathic remedies. So there's something there. We may not completely understand it, but it behooves us to continue to try and understand it because we have proof of clinical efficacy for almost 200 years.
Well, let us remember in closing that reality always supersedes scientific verification. I want to thank you all for being with us. Tony Bart out in Chicago, Dr. Mitchell Fleischer from Virginia, Dr. Ronald Whitmont from Rhinebeck, New York, and Dr. Christopher Johnson from Arlington, Virginia. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, everybody. Pleasure to be with you.
This is Gary Noll, and we are at the end of our Progressive Commentary Hour on homeopathy. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on the next program.